give for that wonderful phrase. To hear those three little
words. I'm joined now by Patricia T. O'Connor. I've always wondered about saying joined by, because it to me it always sounds like, I don't know, Siamese twins or something. Anyway, Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, and the young version of that, Woe Is I Junior, also Words Fail Me and You Send Me, her look at writing in the email era. And we take your calls here at 212-433-9692. We also get a lot of emails, and you get a lot of emails.
I do.
And some of them I send you.
See, I'd be writing twice the number of books.
When you wrote You Send Me, you had no idea that it was going to refer to all of the email that you get as a result of being on the show. Well, but that's some of those things are really fascinating.
Oh, they are.
And our listeners turn out, in many cases, to be quite knowledgeable.
Your listeners know so much more than I do about a lot of this stuff. It's an education for me.
Well, they do the research. And I guess that's the way you find out about all these things. Although there are, as we have learned over the years, some things that you will never be able to figure out because the origins of certain words and phrases are clouded in mystery.
Exactly. No.
Is there something you want to talk about before we take calls?
Well, I did get a wonderful email a few weeks ago from a faithful listener, Anne, in Brooklyn. And her email was so very interesting, I had to bring it along because, you know, we're all sometimes really bugged by lousy English in ads and in corporate publications and whatnot.
Going all the way back to Winston tastes good like a cigarette show.
Yeah. And most of us just wring our hands because we assume we can't do anything about it. But Anne did something about it, and she actually stood up to corporate America and got some results. A few weeks ago, there was a full-page ad in the Times from Allstate, the insurance company, and it was about their retirement planning. It was a very effective ad, and it said, among other things, that the Hallmark card company sold 85,000 happy 100th birthday cards last year, which is something to think about. And the headline on the ad was, how long of a retirement should you plan for? So Anne wrote to the president and CEO of Allstate and pointed out to him
pointed out that
how long of a retirement was a redundancy and not very good English. And lo and behold, he wrote her right back and said, gee, you're right. Thanks for telling us, and we're changing it. And the following week, again, on the following Sunday, another full-page ad from Allstate, the same ad with a different headline, how long a retirement should you plan for? So it just goes to show you that sometimes corporate America listens.
Well, it was the ad copywriter.
She also went to the top. Now, if she had written to the copywriter, he might have said, blow off, lady, or something. But she wrote to the CEO, and what he says goes. So,
well, that's terrific.
Yeah, so it's something to think about. We don't always have to take it. As for that mistake, that how long of a retirement, that's kind of a common redundancy.
Hearing it more and more.
It's like how big of a deal. A lot of people email me about that. And it's a redundant of. Similar usages that don't really need an of that sometimes have them would be, for instance, not that bad a storm, too old an athlete, so evil an empire, so good a movie, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a redundant of that we don't need.
What about graduate from...
graduate college.
Yeah, graduate college. I got lost there because I've always said graduated from college, but people say did he graduate college?
Yeah, right. And as
that's eliminating a word I think that's really important in that sense.
It belongs there, yes. But while I was just waiting to come on, your producers handed me a lot of emails that just came in this afternoon about corporate speak. So I'll share a couple of those. These are expressions that annoy people out there in the office. Here's one from Steve in Baldwin, Long Island. Office speak that he heard just today. Let's level set here. Don't know what that means.
Level set?
Yes, let's level set here. Don't know what that means.
We'll probably find out within a month.
Yeah, also, let's sync up. That probably means let's be on the same page. Uh-huh. That's another one. Here's a caller in Brooklyn. He's annoyed when his boss says, crack open that file. Supposedly just to enliven some office situation. Crack open that file. Matthew.
How big a crack do you think?
I don't know. Matthew is annoyed by, I don't know if he's annoyed about this or he's just sharing it. A verb to Google-mire or to be Google-mired is to be in a state of getting lost in an internet search.
Mm.
Now, Michael in Georgia.
I like that one.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it, to be Google-mired?
I have been Google-mired many times.
Yeah.
Should I go on to the the next, you know, it's already got kind of boring.
Right.
And then you do, and you find something interesting.
Right.
And that pushes you to keep on going, even though you're Google-mired for page after page after page.
And now, Michael in Georgia. We've all heard of the word ginormous, which is a combination of gigantic and enormous. He says a coworker of his invented one, trinominal, which is a combination of tremendous and phenomenal. So out there in Georgia, they're hearing trinominal in the office. I guess it's better than femendous. Anyway, Deborah in New Jersey is annoyed by dead in the water. And here's another office.
What's wrong with dead
lingo.
In the water? I'm sorry.
Well, dead in the water is when you a project is over, it's finished, you can't go any further with it. It's dead in the water.
Yeah, but is that bad? Or just like when people say, that's toast. I understand what they mean. It is
yeah.
Kind of a cliche.
Them, but I think they get annoying when they get
he's
to
toast.
Be cliches.
That's the first time I've ever said it.
When he's toast, he ought to crack open the file once in a while or go Google-mire himself. But here's another.
Well, I know which side to butter him on.
Here's one, a permalancer. Have you heard that word?
Yeah, I just heard it the other day.
Yeah.
That's a freelancer who works every day.
Get benefits.
But doesn't get benefits, but
right.
works just
it's
enough
very
hours
unfair.
To do a job.
Right. Companies hire a supposed temp and keep him or her on doing the work of a full-time person, and they don't have to pay vacation or sort of unfair. Very unfair, actually.
And not uncommon in this business.
No.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and we will be taking your calls in just a few moments at 212-433-9692. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC. And by the way, you can go to Patricia's website, Grammarphobia. The big problem is that people don't always spell grammar correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So they write me angry notes saying, I went to Grammarphobia, spelled wrong. Grammarphobia.com. And then you can click on Pat's blog and see a selection of language questions from the WNYC listeners. You can also ask her a question by emailing her at mailbox@grammarphobia, that's a PH, .com. And what else? Should I take some calls?
Yeah, I did have one other thing I wanted to mention. This was just on the news, or I just saw it on the news. You know, Venezuela hates us, or at least President Hugo Chavez hates us, and he has now told the state phone company workers to avoid English language business terms in the office, speaking of corporate speak. Words like staff, marketing, password, mouse, meeting, and sponsor are outlawed now in Venezuela in the nationalized phone company offices. They're supposed to say equipo for staff, mercadeo for marketing, contraseña for password, ratón for mouse, reunión for meeting, and patrocinador for sponsor.
Well, it seems kind of silly, but we've seen this elsewhere. The French mm-hmm. did that. They tried to outlaw all those English words, and you go to France and you still right. hear people saying them. It doesn't matter what the French Academy says. And I suspect that if you go into some of those offices, unless there's a spy, people will still say, this mouse isn't working.
Well, you know, I think it would be funny if we put a fly on the wall in these offices in Venezuela and found instead of speaking these normal English terms, they were saying, crack open that file.
In Spanish.
Or it's dead in the water.
Okay, let's take some calls.
Okay.
And Steve from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Last night in the debate, there seemed to be a debate in the debate about the words denounce and reject relating to Reverend Farrakhan supporting Obama. And Clinton thought that denounce wasn't as strong enough, he should reject it. But aren't the two synonymous?
Well,
and even if they aren't they equally strong? Denounce sounds stronger to you,
Yeah,
you
denounce
say?
Sounds stronger to me than reject.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Senator Clinton seemed to want him to acknowledge that he was going to reject what Farrakhan said, and he acknowledged it. But they seem to be synonyms.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Write him a letter.
Well, this is, to some degree, that's what political discourse is all about. You said is instead of are, and...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Let's take you to court. Okay, but I do understand the point, and I was confused by that as well. After all, if I say I denounce that, I think that's a pretty strong rejection.
Yeah, that's pretty strong. I think that's more than just rejecting.
Thank you for your call, Steve. Richard from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I also have a question that relates to political language or language used in politics.
How can we avoid it at this time of year?
That's right. I was looking in the dictionary for the definition of the word universal, and it says covering the whole without limit or exception. Now, Senator Clinton has been talking a lot about universal health care plan, but universal... It doesn't her plan where you have to.
Well, we don't want to get to the politics here.
No. This is the clarity of the language I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Her plan requires that the individual pay for the coverage.
Right. There are mandates.
A mandate. Right. Now, calling that universal is like saying there's a movie theater where there are tickets on sale, and anybody can pay to get in. But would that make it a universal movie theater?
Well, one of the definitions of universal is of or related to or affecting all members of the class or group that you're talking about.
It offers coverages to everyone. It offers coverage. You can choose not to take it, but and by the way, there's universal health care in England, but some people choose to go to private doctors.
Sure.
So the use is correct.
It may be a problem with English. I mean, maybe there's no better word than universal here.
Some words like that, Catholic, for example, means universal, doesn't it? And it's kind of lost that meaning, although if people say, I have Catholic tastes, they usually get a raised eyebrow.
Yeah. You think, we shouldn't order fish today.
Thank you for your call. Martin from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I wonder if you could help me with this sentence, please. Here is a sentence. Her skepticism is not rooted in nostalgia, but are the conclusions of a woman who followed scientific and literary debates.
That sounds wrong to me.
Is the conclusion.
Yeah.
Now,
unless it's her skepticisms.
Should it be is or are?
It's is because skepticism is the subject of that sentence, not the conclusion.
I thought, but when you say the sentence, it sounds better. You know, but are the conclusions of a woman, you know, that part of the sentence. But you're saying that is the correct use.
Right.
Because skepticism is the subject of that sentence, and skepticism gets a singular. The conclusions could, if you had switched the sentence around, her conclusions are blah, 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 which leads to some skepticism, that would be perfectly fine as well.
Yes.
Where was this sentence?
it was in the New York Review of Books.
Aha.
And they said is.
Should I say the sentence again?
No, they said are.
Are.
They said are in the New York Review of Books?
Yes, it's her skepticism is not rooted in nostalgia, but are the conclusions of a woman who followed scientific.
Who wrote this article?
I'm sorry, who wrote it? Yeah. Diane Johnson.
Shame on you, or the editor, or whomever.
Thank you very
well,
much.
Well, you know, a lot of publications are cutting back on copy editors, and I don't know that that's the case at the New York Review of Books, but that could be it.
Wow.
Don't underestimate the power of your copy editors.
I used to respect that publication so much until just 2 seconds ago. Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She's written any number of books on the English language, and there may be mistakes, but she sure knows the difference between a singular and a plural. And we will be taking more of your calls at 212-433-9692 right after this.
Words. Oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase to hear those three little words.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, who visits us once a month to talk about the language. With you, we take lots of calls at 212-433-9692. And one of those calls is from Boston. Maybe we should take it before we go on to some of the comments that people have sent on our page. Paul from Boston, I assume, Massachusetts.
That's correct.
Hi. How do you listen to us?
Over the web.
And what is your question?
I wondered why we pluralize email. Like, we don't get mails, so why do we get emails, plural?
And, the mail we always refer to as in the singular, even though other similar words, Pat, like fish, we make distinctions between a singular and a plural.
I do get a lot of questions about this, and I think the way this is all shaking out is that a singular email is an email. Email in general is email, as in I enjoy getting email. But I have received three emails, as in pieces of email.
So I've received email is singular.
Right. And I think that's because we don't treat the word email the same way we treat mail, as in postal mail. We treat it as if it's the word letter
or
message.
I got three emails. I got three letters.
Right.
In the mail.
Right. Right.
Okay.
And I think that's the way it's just working out in common usage. I'm not defending it, but that's the way I see it used.
Great. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And we thank you for your call. By the way, we got a comment from a listener who explains what level set is.
Oh, good.
Or at least it makes sense. Joseph says level set may have originated in the audio engineering world. It's actually probably a bit stale now. I always understood the term to mean establishing a factual basis as well as establishing boundaries for further deliberation and discussion. So
it would mean,
well, level set.
Let's make sure we all
agree
where
set our level.
We are,
well, we'll all set the levels and everybody will be equal and then we can start from there. Another person wonders, since we talked about denounce, what about renounce? Now, there is a real distinction between renounce and denounce, isn't there?
Right. I'm not sure what it is, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think that I denounce it means that I say that sort of thing is unacceptable, and I renounce means, well, I used to be a member of the Communist Party, but I renounce that.
This
affiliation
is
now.
Something that you already had that you're pushing away from you, whereas just denouncing, you could be refusing to accept something in the first place.
He never was a member of the Nation of Islam, and so there's no need to renounce it. There's only a reason to denounce what Louis Farrakhan said.
Right.
Okay, let's take some more calls. Our next caller is Judy from Chappaqua.
Hi.
I love to say Chappaqua. Westchester is not so nice, but Chappaqua.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the expression carrot and stick, carrot and stick approach. My understanding was that you never quite got the carrot, that the carrot was always attached to the stick. And I hear a lot of political commentators saying, well, it's either the carrot or the stick.
Mm-hmm.
which mm-hmm. sense of connotes something entirely different, which is, you know, you're going to get either the whipping from the stick or you're going to get the prize of the mm-hmm. carrot, versus what my understanding was, it's sort of like the horse is forever running and not quite ever getting the carrot because it's held attached to the stick and you never quite get the prize. Could you explain that?
You probably won't believe this, but this call came in maybe 3 years ago, and it launched a huge discussion that went on indefinitely. There are two schools of thought, and they both have bases in fact. One school of thought is that the carrot and stick refers to a carrot being dangled at the end of a stick and held by someone who's riding a mule, say, mm-hmm. dangled in front of the mule's face so that the mule goes forward. Right. And there are scenes to this effect in, like, Our Gang comedies, that kind of thing.
And that's my understanding of it.
Right, that you dangle the carrot in front of the mule's face by means of the stick. Now, there's another school of thought, and this one also has some historical fact, that the stick is a weapon held in one hand, the carrot is the reward held in the other, and that if the person being driven obeys the jogging of the stick, he gets the carrot as a reward. So there are two whole different gestalts here mm-hmm, mm-hmm. as far as carrot and stick.
So there is a carrot and stick approach,
right?
Which refers
right.
to really
the carrot or the stick, and there's a carrot and stick.
So both are right.
Yes, yes.
A listener wonders, and this is one of those things I think that just the language is inconsistent, but wonders why we say autopsy when aut means self. We're not self-examining when we're a cadaver, and we could say necropsy.
Well, I have heard the word necropsy.
Yeah, there is a real word.
Yeah.
But we say autopsy, and it's a perfectly acceptable word.
Yeah.
But aut always means self, doesn't it?
Well, usually. Wait, let me look up autopsy and see what the actual roots are here. That sometimes helps. Okay, autopsy. Okay, the roots are auto.
Yeah, which is
foreseeing. Oh, no, auto for oneself and opsis for seeing. So seeing for oneself. To subject to an autopsy is to see for yourself.
We're seeing for ourselves.
So it's the doctor who's seeing for himself or the pathologist, I guess, what happened. So that's it.
Okay. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Mike is from Newark.
Yes, hi. Could you please tell me the origins of the phrase, it's a gas?
Nope. I don't know the origin of that.
It's a gas means it's really something quite great. Mm-hmm. And all the other gas things are negatives. You know, he's
but
a gas bag.
Why a gas?
Well, no. maybe it has to do with the gas that the dentist gives you that makes you laugh, the laughing gas.
Hmm.
I was told it's a reference to the pleasure of flatulence.
Well,
could
does that
be
make sense.
Who gets the pleasure out of it?
only the guy's an old fart. I have no idea whether that's true. One person writes here. Oh, Chris writes. I notice a lot of people using misnomer when they probably mean error or mistake, and I've heard that a lot too.
Yeah, I have too.
Misnomer is one of those misused words.
Right. Someone will say that, to say that 2 and 2 = 5 is a misnomer.
And this person says he heard it on the BBC this morning.
Mm.
The New York Review of Books, the BBC.
Now the BBC.
What is this world coming to? This person writes, Ken, I love sanction. Is there another word with multiple opposite meanings?
Mm-hmm. And they're called autonyms, I think. Cleave.
Autonyms of the autopsy? No,
yeah, cleave is another one.
Uh-huh.
You can cleave
hang
to someone, or if you cleave, you can split something in two. There are a few others, but they escape me right now. But I think they're called autonyms.
Mm-hmm. So, and
mm-hmm. that they mean their own opposites.
And that is weird. I wonder how that happens. I
don't know.
For example, a word like fulsome, mm-hmm. we understand what happened there. It started off to mean one thing, and then it got used almost ironically, and so it came to mean its opposite.
Uh-huh.
But then the original meaning was lost, except when people use it incorrectly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But I think
unless
probably
you're going to prison.
I think that the way things like cleave come to mean different things, they probably come from the same root, but they diverge at some point. So it's not that there was any mistake about them, as with fulsome.
Larry, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Leonard. Hi, Pat. I have two quick questions. Pat, could you explain to me the use of should and would in the subjunctive? When do we use it and for what reason?
Let's see. He told me that I should go. That's using should in the subjunctive.
Okay.
Also, he requested that I go. Then go is in the subjunctive. This is a kind of a large issue to explain on the air.
In this sentence, in the 1950s, the idea was that schools should teach anything that would increase a student's job marketability.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. But why can't we say schools should teach anything that will increase?
Oh, that's a problem with the sequence of tenses. If you use will, you should say the schools shall teach things that will increase marketability. Or they ought to teach things that would increase marketability.
Okay.
It's just a different way you use different tenses together.
Okay, very good. And this is one quick second question. When Roger Clemens spoke at the hearing, he used the word misremembered. Is there such a word? I never really heard that word, misremembered.
Actually, there is a word like that, but you don't hear it very often, and it comes across as illiterate.
I thought he misspoke.
I think there is a word, misremember, however.
It does make sense because there is no other way of saying that.
It's not the same as forgot. It may be I remembered incorrectly. Yeah, right.
But misremembered is a quicker way of saying that.
Now, I wanted to bring up a question that maybe some listeners will have some ideas about this. I got a very interesting email about a woman who said she wondered, has the spelling of dilemma changed in the past 35 years or so? D-I-L-E-M-M-A, because she could have sworn that in her childhood, when she learned to spell in the 60s, it was spelled dilemma with M-N-A.
Mm-hmm. I remember that,
dilemma,
too.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she had thought it was spelled D-I-L-E-M-N-A, and she remembers it distinctly because the teacher taught them to pronounce it phonetically, almost as a joke, to say dilemma. And it was along the same lines as words like solemn and condemn and whatnot. Now, I did some checking out of this, and I was bowled over to find that, well, dilemma has never been spelled with an N. I've never found a single dictionary that's ever had it spelled with an N. However, there are people all over the English-speaking world who insist that they were taught to spell it D-I-L-E-M-N-A. This is in England, Australia, the United States, elsewhere where English is spoken, and even, believe it or not, even in France, where the word dilemma is spelled D-I-L-E-M-M-E, there are French people who insist that they were once taught to spell it D-I-L-E-M-N-E. Now, there are no spelling books, no dictionaries, or anything backing this up.
This was collective insanity, and I'm part of
you too. I asked a friend of mine this recently. He says, oh, sure, I was taught that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who are these
teachers?
I
always have to remind myself to put two M's there because the N is the way I remember it from my childhood.
Now, that's very, very weird because I can't imagine who these teachers would be. They must
have
come from another planet.
This is a dilemma.
It's a big mystery. It's a complete mystery. And my mouth was hanging open as I was finding all these discussion groups for people saying, I wish I could remember who that teacher was who taught me to spell it with an N, and everyone else agreeing,
I was taught the N too.
So I'm just wondering if there are other people out there, or if this is all an elaborate hoax to drive me crazy. But it's very strange.
Marilyn from Staten Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to report that last night after the debates, Chris Matthews said, come join Keith and I.
Oh, well.
But Chris Matthews.
Write him a letter.
Well,
maybe write his boss
a letter. You know, get that silly grin off your face.
On the other hand,
Hillary Clinton.
Let us be fair. Let us be fair. When you're speaking off the top of your head, sometimes you misspeak.
Yeah, this is a second one. How did this phrase come about, I want to sleep in, rather than I want to sleep late?
I don't know how that came about. But I will say this. English, because it's an amalgam of so many other different languages, has prepositions up the wazoo, so to speak. We have more prepositions than we have any need for, and foreign speakers have a lot of trouble with English because of this, and most of them are idiomatic. And we have any number of ways for saying things, like, why do we say we turn the light on, or we turn the alarm on, and we shut it off, but we send off a letter, or we put on a coat, we take off a coat.
I mean, we stay in the driveway.
Right, right. There are all kinds of weird ways that we use prepositions. Sleep in is an example. Eat out, eat in. It's all idiomatic. That's all I can say. It's not a good answer, but that's the only answer.
Well, in case you have some answers or you want to compare notes with Patricia T. O'Connor, you can go to her website, grammarphobia.com, and click on Pat's blog to see what our listeners are writing about and also her thoughts on the language. You can ask her a question as well by emailing her at mailbox@grammarphobia.com, or you can read any of her books. The list is growing. Woe is I Junior, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and I suspect there's something else in the works.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
It's
Words Fail Me Junior? No, don't tell me. Anyway,
it's all new.
We'll see you next month, Pat. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming
by. Thank you for having
by.
Me.